laugh hysterically with their mutual enjoyment and mastery of the art of passing gas. While there's no doubt that my dad and Erica genuinely loved Diego, I think they were also relieved that my life had turned a corner and felt grateful that I had found someone stable and positive. Our relationship was pretty damn wholesome from my perspective. We made art for each other and took his nephews to Disneyland. I would do my homework while he practiced with the band. We even got tattoos of each other's names. This is not to say that he and I didn't do our share of dumb things together. Getting in fistfights with random people who disrespected us, going on car chases through Hollywood, eating magic mushrooms and seeing natural-born killers. But we took care of each other in a very loving way and provided each other with the kind of home base we both needed. Whereas before, I was just kind of ambling around, trying things out and attempting to find myself. This relationship gave me an identity that no one could mess with. I was part of a team now, and we were a pretty kick-ass duo, if I do say so myself. Stuart Saves His Family, 1995. Written by Al Franken, directed by Harold Ramis. 12-step enthusiast and self-help personality Stuart Smalley, Al Franken, struggles to follow his own advice as he deals with his dysfunctional family and their issues of emotional abuse, alcoholism, and codependency. A comedy. Stuart, you're good enough, you're smart enough, and doggone it, people like you. The idea for the movie came from someone with no SNL connection, though he'd worked with several alumni, Harold Ramis. As Franken remembers it, the director of Caddyshack and National Lampoon's Vacation read the Daily Affirmations book that was published in the fall of 1992, then contacted Franken about the possibility of turning it into a film. Michael signed off and lent his support, but Franken said, "It was really done on the West Coast. It was Harold's baby. I think Lauren trusted Harold, and I think Lauren really liked the movie." Eric D. Snyder, Vanity Fair. The beauty of Stuart Saves His Family, written by Franken and directed by Harold Ramis, is that it's somehow true to Stuart at the same time it sees the humor in him. You'd think he might become obnoxious at feature length, but he becomes more likable, especially because of his unforgiving self-criticism. Listen to me, I'm shitting all over myself. The movie is also unobtrusively wise about the real nature of the problems in Stuart's family and doesn't offer easy solutions or a phony happy ending. I not only enjoyed Stuart Smalley, doggone it, I liked him, and that attitude of gratitude ain't just a platitude. Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times. In the summer of 1994, I worked as a production assistant on Stuart Saves His Family. Stuart was a spin-off of the SNL character Stuart Smalley, a formerly obese, asexual, self-help addict who had a show on the Public Access Channel and ended every episode with the line, "Remember, you're good enough, you're smart enough, and doggone it, people like you." My dad rewrote Al's original script but was not credited as a writer. The Writers Guild of America states that a director-writer has to contribute more than 50% of the writing to an original screenplay in order to be credited. During the making of Stuart, Dad and Erica were expecting their second child, and she and I were not getting along. I was living with my mom full-time, and Dad figured my working on the set would give us a good chance to spend some quality time together, 12 hours a day for 3 months. Whether I sucked at the PA gig or they just expected very little of me, it's hard to know. Either way, it was better than dishing out froyo at TCBY because I basically got paid to hang out with my dad and a bunch of other awesome people, smoke cigarettes, and gain 10 pounds eating bit of honey at the craft service table. Oddly, I was probably more starstruck by the actors in Stuart than in any other of my dad's movies. Apart from Al Franken, who had been a part of such a great SNL cast over the previous 5 years, my friends and I were obsessed with the movie Scarface at the time, so getting to bring Harris Yulin bottles of water was like a dream come true. Throw in Vincent D'Onofrio, whom I loved from Full Metal Jacket, and Adventures in Babysitting, shh, Laura San Giacomo from Pretty Woman, and Louis Arquette, unbelievable mensch and father to Rosanna and Patricia, and I was genuinely in awe. Although I did have a line in the film, "Stuart, phone." Being on the set made me realize I was not interested in following in my dad's footsteps. The Hollywood life simply did not fit in with my worldview, and I lacked the blind self-confidence that seemed essential to most of the aspiring actors and filmmakers I knew. Also, and this may sound ridiculous, I have a lazy eye, which I assumed would prevent me from ever being successful as an actor. Rather than facing the inevitable rejection, I just decided that the entertainment biz was not for me. It was great to watch my dad in action on a movie set, though. Directing really brought out all of his best qualities. His creativity, humor, intelligence, organization, leadership, and compassion were ever present. He knew everybody's name on the crew and made sure to keep the shooting days short so people could still have some semblance of a life outside of the typically grueling production schedule. Everyone appreciated his approach and often said that his sets were the most pleasant work environments they'd ever experienced. Stuart Saves His Family did not do well at the box office and was largely panned by critics. Some friends of mine even confessed that they'd walked out of a free test screening. Thanks a lot, guys. I guess dramedies about 12-step programs and dysfunctional families weren't in yet. My dad said in an interview with The Believer in 2006, "It had some painful stuff in it. When we showed it to focus groups, some of them actually said, 'If I want to see a dysfunctional family, I'll stay home.'" Although Al hadn't made the leap to politics yet, he was friends with the Clintons, and we all got to go to Washington, D.C. for a special screening in the White House Theater. Hillary said she loved the film, so I guess even then she was a little out of touch with the wider audience. In any case, my dad really loved this movie, and having watched it recently with my kids, I think it holds up. Putting the Stuart Smalley character and 12-step context aside, it's well-written, full of heartfelt and genuine performances, and tells an important story about moving beyond family trauma, building healthy relationships, and learning to love yourself. If you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor. Grab a pound cake and a box of tissues, curl up on the couch, press play, and let the healing begin. Your walls will not protect you. When I was a senior in high school, my dad and brothers were robbed at gunpoint in their Brentwood home. Erica was out to dinner, and my dad was asleep in bed with both boys. Julian was about 4 at the time, and Daniel was just a baby. Two young guys, reportedly Crips, had followed one of the neighbors' Mercedes home, intending to rob them, but were thwarted by a speedy automatic gate. They reported later that they had no idea where they were and decided to look for another house. My dad's house was dark and there was a big wall around it, and while there was an alarm system, it wasn't on. They hopped the wall, found an open door, and went inside. My dad said he was half asleep when he heard a loud click. He opened his eyes, saw a gun pointed at his head, put his hands up, and slowly got out of bed. As the mattress shifted, 4-year-old Julian woke up. "Who are those guys?" Julian asked sleepily. "Oh, they're just here to get something, and then they're gonna leave," my dad said calmly. "Put your head down and go back to sleep." "Where are your guns, and where's your safe?" the guys demanded. "We don't have any guns, but I'll give you everything else, please, my kids. I'm not looking at you. I'll give you whatever you want." He went on to give them several expensive watches and all of his cash and credit cards. As they were arguing about what to do next, the phone rang. It was Erica calling to let my dad know she was on her way home. "Okay," he said in an unnaturally bright voice. "Thanks for the info. Just keep doing what you're doing." "Harold, what's wrong?" she asked. "Oh, nothing. You're doing great. There's no hurry." "Harold, what's going on?" She was panicking, imagining that something terrible had happened to one of the boys. "Is everything okay?" "Oh, not really." "Is there someone in the house?" "Yep." "Should I call the police?" "Yeah, that would be great. Okay, bye." By the time the police came, the guys were long gone. They were caught later that night after pointing their guns at a cop car parked near their neighborhood in South Central LA. As the police chased them, they started throwing my dad's credit cards out the window. The next morning, after he told me the story, I cried, knowing how easily it could have gone badly and how close I'd come to losing him and my brothers. We joked later that he should have offered them some of his pricey sculptures and paintings, but he said he had a feeling they were not art lovers. Through the whole ordeal, he maintained amazing compassion for the robbers. He said they were basically just kids themselves, and, as scared as he was in the moment, he had a sense that they had been touched by the sight of him curled up with the boys and knew they didn't want to hurt him. Except for a quick item in one gossip mag, the story did not get picked up. Maybe now, in the age of the relentless 24-hour news cycle, it would have, or maybe my dad was never really that kind of celebrity. He used to say he was just the right amount of famous, meaning he was known enough to get a good table at a restaurant, but not so well known that he couldn't fly under the radar. He was also a vocal supporter of gun control and didn't want his experience turned into propaganda for armed self-defense. In any case, this was an incident he was more than happy to just leave quietly behind him. Even though I wasn't living with him anymore, there was no doubt that my dad was the most important person in my life, and the close call of the robbery was like an admonition from the universe. Hey, anything can happen at any moment, so don't waste time fighting the people you love. Just love them. Concord Class of 1995. As my high school years drew to a close, my relationships with all my parents were in a relatively good place. Erica and I were still hot and cold, light and sweet one minute, oppressive and intolerable the next, and my mom was still her unpredictable and challenging self, but it was much better with both of them than it had been in years prior. Though our conflicts had never been that serious, my dad and I had let go of whatever tension we had, reinstated our old divorce dad night, and tried to make the most of our last few months of living in the same city before I went off to college. My dad and I were both asked to speak at my high school graduation, along with my pal Ethan and his dad, Reverend Jim Kahn. Jim made a great speech that day about Jonah and the whale, in which he encouraged everyone to go out into the world and get swallowed up by something. My dad loved Jim's speech and quoted it often over the years. "Doesn't really matter what you do," he'd say. "Just get out there and get into it, anything. Get passionate. Get in that whale." Ethan mumbled something about how much he was looking forward to going to college and how our high school experience had prepared him well for a life of creativity and critical thinking. I spoke about what I thought would appeal to the students, parents, and school, finding balance after the tumult of adolescence and how Concord had offered me an environment that was the perfect mix of challenging and nurturing, structured and flexible, rigorous and relaxed. I think it was good, but who knows? My dad, of course, knocked it out of the park. Here is his speech from that day. Concord Commencement, June 12th, 1995. Thank you, Sonia. I'm very happy to be here and very, very proud of my wonderful daughter. When Sonia asked me to speak here, I had no idea what I'd say, but I started thinking back on the last 4 years and wondered if most of the families here today didn't have the same experience. I once heard it said that God made teenagers so parents wouldn't feel bad when their kids finally left home. Violet was about 13 at the time, and I laughed when I heard it, but by the time she turned 14, I stopped laughing. She'd always had a mind of her own, but now it was getting ridiculous. She was rude, disrespectful, hostile, and rebellious. She questioned every decision, challenged every rule. She knew everything, I knew nothing. It was almost impossible to have a conversation without one or both of us getting hurt or angry. I felt like I was being tested every day. "I want a tattoo. I want to get my nose pierced. You don't trust me. Who says you have to finish high school? Not everyone's like you, you know." One battle after another. "Don't worry," I asked her if I could talk about these things, and she said it was okay. I remember she once told me, "I want to paint my room black." "You can't paint your room black." "Why not? It's my room." "Don't you think a black room might be a little gloomy?" I asked her. She rolled her eyes. "Dad, kids are into gloom." Boy, was she ever. Then a wise friend told me that there were three keys to getting along with teenagers. 1, don't be punitive. Do what I say or you're staying in for the next 147 weekends or whatever. 2, don't be judgmental. "You're not wearing that to school, you look like Madonna," etc. 3, don't be moralistic. "So I suppose if everyone else jumped off a cliff, you would too?" I thought, if I can't be punitive, judgmental, or moralistic, what have I got left? Then I started to realize that what I had left was my deep, abiding love for my daughter. My concern for her health, her safety, and her well-being. My desire to see her grow and learn and flourish. my wish that she would find something to do in life that she loved, and then have the opportunity and good fortune to earn a living at it. That she would be socially responsible, helpful, concerned, and productive. That she would form warm, caring, wholesome relationships with people she respected who respected her. From that point on, I backed off. Maybe not far enough for Violet, but as far as I could. I tried not to be critical. I started to trust her for better or worse. I tried to focus on feelings and wishes, mine and hers, and little by little, things started to get better. We didn't agree on everything. We still don't. But I think the war ended some time ago, and we've enjoyed a couple of years of relative peace. It's fun again. Mark Twain said something like, "When I was 14, I realized my father didn't know anything. Then when I turned 18, I was amazed how much he'd learned in 4 years." I think Violet is getting to that point. She actually asks me for advice now, and she even takes it sometimes. So what advice would I give her now? I'd say to her what I want to say to all of you graduating today. I remember a study done many years ago. A group of little kids were surveyed about what they wanted to be when they grew up. You can imagine the responses. Cowboy, astronaut, ballerina, fireman, pilot, professional athlete, movie star. The usual dreams we all have as kids. Then they asked the same children the same question when they were 17 or 18. Now the answers were lawyer, doctor, MBA, much more practical and certainly useful, but I hope you all keep in mind that we still need cowboys and ballerinas. Somebody's got to do it, and it could be you. I guess I'm saying if you have a dream, give it a try. You might just make it. I'm not going to tell you that you're the hope of the future or that it's up to you to save the world. That's up to all of us. But I think you have to do good wherever and whenever you can. And get educated. It might happen in a college or university, but the important thing is to keep learning. Can't get enough of that at any age. And of course, just do it, go for the gold, be all that you can be. But remember, as the Zen poet said, the miracle is not to walk on water. The miracle is to walk on the earth. So let me conclude by returning to that statement I heard 5 years ago, that God made teenagers so parents wouldn't feel bad when their kids left home. Now I know. It isn't funny, and it isn't true. I love my teenager, and as proud and happy for her as I am, I hate to see her go. Good luck, and God bless you all. After the ceremony, Dad and Erica took me, Diego, my mom, and a few close family friends to lunch at the Regent Beverly Wilshire. We toasted graceful endings and new beginnings and all breathed a collective sigh of relief that we'd emerged, intact, on the other side of some very tough years. Multiplicity, 1996. Written by Chris Miller, Mary Hale, Lowell Gantz, and Babalu Mandel. Directed by Harold Ramis. There just isn't enough time in the day for overworked and overwhelmed Doug Kinney, Michael Keaton, a busy husband and father who is struggling to make it all work. When a scientist offers a quick fix to his problems through cloning, Doug finds himself finally getting the free time he wants, but in danger of losing the things that are the most important to him. Doug. I feel guilty for not spending enough time with my family. Then I get resentful because I don't have enough time for myself. Work is first, my family is a close second, and I'm a distant third. More Kafka-esque than comedic, more fascinating to watch than out-and-out funny. Kenneth Turin, Los Angeles Times. Director Harold Ramis had more serious ambitions. Multiplicity should have been another Groundhog Day, which Ramis also directed, but he comes up short. Mick LaSalle, San Francisco Chronicle. Multiplicity took a one-joke premise, Michael Keaton clones himself and wackiness ensues, and made it into a winning story that deftly juggles humor, elaborate special effects, and a surprisingly thoughtful look at the challenges of balancing work and family. Peter Subsinski, RogerEbert.com. As my dad settled into his 50s, he got deeper into his study of psychology and the exploration of what it meant to be a man, a straight, white, moneyed man. On the surface, he appeared to fulfill the roles of his own hyphenated life with relative ease, cheerfully and seamlessly switching back and forth between his roles as actor, writer, director, husband, father, and son. Internally, he was feeling the pressure of balancing personal, professional, and societal expectations. Real men are supposed to be Casanovas and seduce as many women as they can, but at the same time, a real man is faithful to his wife and family. We're supposed to be strong, aggressive, and competitive, but also caring, understanding, and emotional. We need to work hard at our jobs, but then have time to take the family skiing and drive the kids to ballet and karate lessons and the orthodontist, keep the car clean, read a book, and even think a thought, he told the Daily News in 1996. Whereas much of his pre-Groundhog Day work focused outward on society and institutions, Multiplicity continued his cinematic exploration of psychology and his own internal growth. When his friend and Animal House collaborator, Chris Miller, sent over a short story he'd written about an advertising exec who gets cloned after feeling torn between his family and career, my dad jumped on board right away. In the original story, the man gets two clones and keeps them in the attic. Eventually, he tries to reclaim his work and family, but the clones refuse to let him back into his own life. My dad loved the premise, but felt the message of the ending was too cynical. I thought it was a wonderful setup because it is common to everybody. We all wish we could be in more than one place at the same time. Working people with families probably feel guilty all the time. If we spend too much time with our family, we feel we're not working hard enough. Then I realized it wasn't just about being busy. It was really about the divided self, and that we are all several different people. There are different aspects of our nature that are competing. I realized that what the story really was about was how this guy fragments into his different component selves and finally gets reintegrated. That's the happy ending, he said in an interview with Psychology Today in 1996. My dad worked with Chris and his wife, Mary Hale, to incorporate the mythopoetic male archetypes into the characters, king, lover, warrior, magician, fool, and to ask probing questions about the psychology of man. They then passed the script on to Lowell Gantz and Babalu Mandel for a final rewrite and polish. My dad was a huge fan of theirs from Splash, Parenthood, and City Slickers, and felt that their contributions to Multiplicity really elevated the material. My dad's producing partner, Trevor Albert, described it as a joyous development process, but the actual production proved to be somewhat less so. There was some back and forth in terms of the casting. My dad was a fan of Michael Keaton and felt that his energy and versatility could really bring the Doug Kinney and clone characters to life. Andy McDowell had been great in Groundhog Day and, for my dad, seemed to epitomize a kind of lovely and non-threatening womanhood. The rest of the cast was filled out with a group of tried-and-true comedic actors and friends. Eugene Levy, Stephen Campman and his wife, Judith Kahn, Harris Yulin, and Brian Doyle Murray, among others. Because the movie called for meticulous and innovative special effects to make four Michael Keatons believable on screen, my dad returned to Richard Edlund and Laszlo Kovacs, whom he had worked with on Ghostbusters. The shooting was difficult, not only because the special effects required extensive coverage and precision for each shot with the clones, but because Michael Keaton was going through changes in his personal life, Courtney Cox, and seemed to chafe under the pressure of carrying the whole movie on his shoulders. In an interview with UpRocks in 2015, Michael Keaton said that he thought the movie wasn't successful because my dad's Buddhism prevented him from pushing the studio to promote it as strongly as they could have. I call bullshit on that theory. You can't blame the Buddha. But at this point, it's neither here nor there. Multiplicity tested well with audiences, but the studio chose not to market the film aggressively, and it ended up making back only half of its $45 million budget. As he had been with Club Paradise and Stuart, my dad was sanguine about the lack of enthusiasm for Multiplicity. Because he had decided to only make movies that meant something to him, the returns mattered less than whether or not he believed in the message and quality of the project, and he stood behind both. I, however, am not so sure about this one. While there are some funny moments in the movie, and I appreciate my dad's authentic fascination with the subject of male identity, to me, Multiplicity just never went far enough out of its own bubble to be truly compelling. Sorry, Dad. Go Slugs. When it was time for me to go to college, my dad insisted that the most important thing was that I had to leave home. His own college experience was such a transformative time in his life, and he wanted to make sure that I didn't miss out on an important growth opportunity. At the time, I was living with Diego at my mom's house and was loath to be separated from him. While my dad accepted Diego warmly as part of the family, he worried that I was sacrificing my own growth and development for the stability and comfort of the relationship. He wanted me to get out and experience the world. I wanted to stay home and be a good girlfriend while Diego made music. As a compromise, I applied to all of the University of California schools and USC. Dad helped me write my admission essay, and the only thing I remember is the opening line. I got the right side of my brain from my mom and the left side from my dad, and I've spent the last 18 years figuring out how to balance the two. I wanted to write about the differences between my two worlds, but it was his idea to lead with a joke. Listen, do you know how many essays these admissions people have to read? And do you know how many of them are actually interesting? Not that many. So if you can make them laugh, even a little bit, trust me, they'll appreciate it. You just think comedy is the answer to everything, Daddy. Well, duh. We laughed. Look, I'm not saying that opening with a joke will get you into college, but it can't hurt, right? I guess he was right. I was accepted at the University of California at Santa Cruz and decided to attend because it was far enough away to be on my own without going so far as to be really alone. My dad and I agreed that I would live in the dorm for the first trimester and then look for an apartment or house to share after that. Diego would stay with my mom, but visit every other weekend and move in once I got established. At the time, UCSC was one of the smaller UC schools, with about 9,000 undergraduate students. The university's mascot was the banana slug, which should give you a pretty good indication of how anti-animal house my college experience was. Nestled in the redwood forests above the city of Santa Cruz, the school was divided into 8 different colleges, each with its own distinct character and academic concentration, and you picked the one where you wanted to live and take your fresh person core class. I picked Porter because it was known as the artsy college and was slightly less hippie-ish than some of the others. My roommate, Jen, not her real name, apparently hadn't gotten this memo and was a true blue tie-dyed deadhead from Kansas. She put up a huge batik peace sign tapestry, got her lip pierced in the bathroom, and ran naked through the quad the first time it rained, as per Porter tradition. I mostly stayed in our room smoking weed and playing Tetris on my laptop. I was so crazy homesick for the first few days after moving into my dorm that I wasn't sure I was going to be able to stick it out. Hearing this, Dad came up for the weekend to tide me over and give me some TLC. We walked around downtown Santa Cruz, took my roommate out for sushi, and bought shower shoes at Long's Drugs. Nothing special, but his presence there helped so much. Like always, he was able to put things in perspective and reassure me in a way that no one else could. "It's gonna be great," he told me. "Maybe not next week or even next month, but if you give it a chance, I know you'll love it." "But the hippies. Oh, the hippies," he laughed. "For me, it was the squares. Listen, it takes time to find your people, but you will. Is there a Black Panther chapter you could join?" "Ha fucking ha," I rolled my eyes. "I don't need Black Panthers, but it would be nice to find someone who smells good and doesn't listen to Neil Young all the time." "What about Van Morrison? Are you okay with him?" "Just hang in there, my baby. You can make some temporary friends while you figure it all out. It doesn't need to be a perfect match. Give it time. Trust me." He was right, of course. After the first trimester, I left the dorm. Diego came up, and we moved into a shared house near Westcliff with another couple from L.A., a punk rockabilly girl, a Siamese cat, and an iguana. Diego went to Cabrillo College in Aptos, the next town over, to study music, and I ended up making great friends, learning from some incredible professors, and finding my little niche after all. Dad visited us in Santa Cruz semi-regularly, often in conjunction with a guest lecture for the film studies department or a trip to San Francisco to visit his old college friends. He was interested in the things I was reading and learning as an American studies major and, amazingly, read Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism on my recommendation. Impressive, right? I decided to minor in education and was a classroom assistant in a bilingual first-second grade class in San Jose for a year. I loved working with kids and was happy that my dad supported my interest in teaching as a possible career. At some point toward the end of my freshman year, Dad and Erica decided to move to Chicago. He had been thinking about it for a while and used to joke, "Nobody cares about me in L.A. There's always someone better two tables over. Also, I'm tired of sucking in my stomach all the time." I think that was partly true, but really, he wanted to be closer to my grandparents and give my brothers a life more similar to the one he had as a kid. I realized my parents have probably only seen you like 25 times in your life. That's so sad. I grew up with my grandparents and all my cousins around all the time, and it was great. I want more of that for the boys, he told me. Erica had grown up in L.A. and all of her family and friends were there, but she hated the earthquakes, had been shaken by the robbery, and agreed that a simpler life for Julian and Daniel would be better. So they sold their house in Brentwood, packed up their life, and transported it to Glencoe, Illinois. I was busy with my own life in Santa Cruz and knew my dad would still be in L.A. regularly for work. Although he worried about my feeling abandoned, I reassured him that I was happy to visit the whole family in the Midwest during school breaks, and it would all be okay. I think it says a lot that I was so secure in my dad's availability and love for me that he could have moved halfway around the world and I'd have known he'd be there for me whenever I needed him. Even though my dad had grown up in Chicago, the move was still an adjustment for him and a bit of a culture shock for Erica. Although the majority of their L.A. circle of friends had not been celebrities or people in the biz, they had a diverse social world with many creative and intellectual people who were interested in arts, culture, politics, and travel. Erica was surprised to find that many of the other parents in the boys' school community had grown up in Glencoe and never left. "It's not that they're not nice," Erica explained to me over the phone soon after the move. "They're very nice. It's just different. I started talking about Buddhism and meditation at a school function, and the other moms looked at me like I had two heads. I don't mean to sound like a snob, but there's just not the same sophistication that I'm used to. I mean, it's not podunk, but it's definitely not L.A. Maybe I need to join a book club." "Maybe you could start your own," I laughed. "You could call it People Who Like to Think and Talk About Things." Part of my dad and Erica's agreement around the move was that he would try to work in Chicago and, at the very least, would not do any location work for 1 year. They got my brothers adjusted to their new schools, saw my grandparents 3 times a week, and slowly started to make some new friends. Though my dad had pictured spending weekends with all of his cousins and having the boys grow up in a tight-knit extended family, it didn't really work out that way. I thought everyone was always getting together and having barbecues without us, but it turns out they weren't. Everyone has their own lives, and we see them a few times a year, just like when I lived in L.A. Oh well, family. They just don't make them like they used to. After the initial settling-in period, my dad really embraced his Midwestern homecoming. He took the role of hometown hero seriously and was active in several civic projects through Mayor Daley's office. Principal for a Day, the Chicago Humanities Festival, Gallery 37, and more. He coached the boys' basketball teams, set up an Ocean Pictures office in Highland Park, and enjoyed the regularness of day-to-day life. He knew the owners of all the diners and mom-and-pop shops he frequented, liked being recognized by the suburban moms, and seemed to relax into the slower, friendlier world. In 1999, he mused about the move in North Shore magazine, saying, "In a normal life, you would know as many people as know you. But for me, more people know me than I know. It's a nice, comfortable, safe feeling." For him, living in the North Shore was a lot like Mayberry, but with Starbucks and Nordstrom Rack. For me, our relationship stayed strong, and I was happy that he felt embraced by his new, old home. What now? My senior year of college, 1998 and 99, I was on my own for the first time in my life. Diego had been accepted to Berklee College of Music in Boston, and I had originally planned to join him there after graduation to pursue a master's in education. It was a good plan, and he was and is a great guy, but it didn't work out. Things got messy pretty quickly when I went to Mexico City in September with my friend Sonara and met a guy. He was Sonara's cousin's best friend, and we rode motorcycles all around the huge city, went to the pyramids, and drank beer on the painted boats of Xochimilco. It was pretty romantic, even when he couldn't stop looking at me in the side-view mirror and crashed our motorcycle into the highway median, dragging us both across 15 feet of asphalt. My right leg looked like hamburger meat, but I didn't care. I called my dad crying. I met a boy and we kissed and then we got into a motorcycle accident and now I don't know what to do. Thank God you're okay, he said. I could kill you for getting on a motorcycle at all. Please don't ever do that again. Now, go figure out how to deal with this mess. I love you, my baby. Everything will be okay. Tell Diego we love him and we'll always be here for him no matter what. Looking back, I recognize that I created a dramatic situation to allow me to exit my relationship with Diego. He was such a good guy, and we were so comfortable together, but my heart just wasn't in it anymore. I ended up letting the guy from Mexico stay with me in Santa Cruz for 3 drama-filled months. He spoke in Spanish, and I spoke in English, and I think we understood about 75% of what the other person was saying. The sex was amazing, though. Ultimately, we got in one too many fights, and when he tried to make out with my friend, I said I'm packing. That whole period was another major reawakening for me. Who could I be on my own? What did I want? Thankfully, I had a group of wonderful girlfriends who supported me through it all. During my senior year, Dad came to visit during a break in post-production for Analyze This. We sat drinking coffee at Cafe Pergolesi, musing on how much things had changed since the first time he visited. Feels good, right? You made a really nice life for yourself up here. You learned a lot. You have great friends. Well, get ready to leave it all behind. I mean, I'm joking, but not really. It's time to start figuring out what you might want to do after graduation. The truth was, I had no idea what I wanted to do after graduation. 2 of my close friends were going backpacking through Israel and Egypt and invited me to go with them. I considered it, but wasn't sure I could handle the way they intended to travel. I'm too much of a control freak, I told my dad over the phone. Plus, I'm not so sure about Israel. I mean, the politics. Knowing you, you'd end up marrying a Palestinian or finding the one Mexican guy in Israel. If you want to go, of course I'll help you, but what about New York? What about it? I mean, you know I love it there, but it's so expensive and I'd have to have a really good job and... We can help you with all that. Think about it. If not now, when? It would be a real adventure. I considered his proposal, but was still unsure about what to do. Wasn't I supposed to be establishing myself as an adult now? Getting a real job and settling down? How could I do that if I opted to stay on the dole? What kind of job could I actually get with all my big ideas but very few practical skills? Busy completing my coursework and writing my final thesis on immigration, domestic labor, and education, I put off answering these questions for as long as possible. As graduation approached, my dad was asked to speak at the commencement. He absolutely nailed it, again, and ended up using the same speech a few more times after this. But it was worthy of the repetition, and it's worthy of repeating here. UC Santa Cruz Commencement, June 12th, 1999. Thank you, graduates, faculty, families, and friends. When I was asked to speak at this commencement ceremony, I was honored, of course, but more than a little worried about the great responsibility of addressing you on such an important occasion as this. Then I thought back to my own graduation from Washington University in 1966 and realized that I had absolutely no memory of who spoke or a single thing that was said. So, years from now, if anyone asks you about this speech, all you have to remember is that it was really great and it totally changed your life. In fact, you might wonder what you will remember from your college years. I remember that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, but I don't remember what it means. I remember synclines and anticlines. I remember supply and demand, the Council of Trent, the Diet of Worms, and my personal favorite, the Defenestration of Prague, in which someone was apparently thrown out a window, in Prague, apparently, for a reason I cannot recall. I do remember that I could write a pretty good answer on an essay test using the acronym PERSIA, Political, Economic, Religious, Scientific, Intellectual, and Artistic, but I don't remember any of the questions. In one course, I read 11 19th century English novels, but all I remember is a character named Diggory Venn the Rettleman. Rettleman is not a job category you hear much about these days. I guess the centerpiece of any good commencement speech should be some kind of advice to the graduates. As you may know, my own daughter Violet is graduating with you today, and in thinking about what advice I'd want to give her, I thought about my own father, and I realized that in my whole life, the best advice my father ever gave me, the only advice he ever gave me, was, don't go into retail. Simple, but deeply profound, and I pass that along to you for whatever it's worth. Perhaps the most famous father-son advice comes in the first act of Hamlet, from Polonius to his son Laertes as he's going off to college. He says, "And these few precepts in thy memory, give thy thoughts no tongue, nor any unproportioned thought his act. Be thou familiar, but by no means vulgar. Those friends thou hast, and their adoption tried, grapple them unto thy soul with hoops of steel." Bada bada bada. He's basically saying, keep your good friends close, but don't waste time with every idiot who comes along. Let's see, beware the entrance to a quarrel, blah blah blah, give every man thine ear, but few thy voice, take each man's censure, but reserve thy judgment, neither a borrower or a lender be, blah blah blah. This above all to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. The one thing he forgets to tell him is, don't get into a sword fight with Hamlet, he's nuts, he'll kill you. Which is exactly what happens in Act 5. Then it's all, good night, sweet prince, and everybody's lying there dead. Point being, all the good advice in the world won't help you if you just go off and do something stupid. I'm not going to say that you're the hope of the future or that it's up to you to save the world. That's up to all of us. But I think you have to do good wherever and whenever you can. There's a lovely Buddhist belief that says, we owe infinite gratitude to the past, infinite service to the present, and infinite responsibility to the future. And of course, obligatory in any commencement speech, follow your dreams. When I was leaving college, my best friend Michael Schamberg and I made a pact that we would never take a job we had to dress up for, and that we would only do the things we enjoyed. Michael is now a successful movie producer, so we are living proof that one can make a career in the arts. I've since modified my rules. In some jobs, you just have to wear a tie. But I do believe that the real challenge, no matter what field you're in, is to do what you like and like what you do. So, go for the gold, just do it, be all that you can be, but remember, as the Zen poet Thich Nhat Hanh said, the miracle is not to walk on the water. The miracle is to walk on the green earth, dwelling deeply in the present moment, feeling truly alive. So let me close now by wishing you all the political, economic, religious, scientific, intellectual, and artistic success one could hope for. Good luck, and may God, whatever you understand that to mean, bless you. Oh yeah. Everyone's always asking me, Harold, what's the meaning of life? Well, it's pretty naive to think that life has one intrinsic and universal meaning that applies to each and every one of us. The fact is, it's up to you to discover the meaning in each and every moment of your lives. Viktor Frankl, the psychologist, said a great thing. He said, act as if you're living your life for the second time, and you're not going to make the same mistakes again. Analyze This, 1999. Written by Kenneth Lonergan, Peter Tolan, and Harold Ramis. Directed by Harold Ramis. Even gangsters get the blues. When mob boss Paul Vitti, Robert De Niro, starts having panic attacks, he strong-arms therapist Ben Sobel, Billy Crystal, into treating him. As the boundaries between doctor and patient begin to blur, both men struggle hilariously to regain control over their lives. Dr. Ben Sobel. When I got into family therapy, this was not the family I had in mind. Funny partly because De Niro and Crystal do what we expect them to do, and partly because they don't. Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times. Director Harold Ramis keeps the gangsters real and funny at the same time. Bob Fenster, Arizona Republic. Ramis has made a fleet, unself-conscious, eminently enjoyable picture, where one-liners caram merrily like stray bullets and where there's casual ease, like the drape of a sharpster's trousers in the report between its two stars. Stephanie Zacharek, Salon.com. My dad was approached to direct Analyze This right around the time he was relocating to Glencoe, but declined the project when they insisted on filming in New York. When the producers came back a second time, after Dad's self-imposed year-long hiatus was up, he agreed to direct the film. The premise was appealing, the script was solid, and the opportunity to work with Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal was too good to pass up. In his rewrites, Dad focused on the psychology of De Niro's character, the therapy sessions, and the jokes. "I use something from every psychiatrist I know," he told Mark Caro for the Chicago Tribune. "I know so many shrinks, and I've done therapy, usually on a crisis basis, when someone in my family was having a problem, or I was." He isolated two basic questions that he felt were at the heart of psychoanalysis to guide his writing and the character's motivation. What do you really feel, and what do you really want? Describing the casting process to me once, my dad talked about meeting a lot of very nice, wise guys. "Sometimes it's hard to tell how much they're really acting," he said. Joe Vitarelli's audition for Jelly stood out. "Real nice guy, Joe. Very sweet, you know. But you wouldn't guess that by looking at him. So after he reads, and he did great, he throws his arm around my neck, pulls me close, and says, 'Give me the part or I'll throw you out the fucking window.'" I paused for a second, but Joe had this twinkle in his eye and we both laughed, shook hands, and, of course, he got the part. Dad invited me to visit New York while he was there filming Analyze This. "I miss you," he said on the phone, "and Erica and the boys would love to see you too. Plus, you can meet Bob, De Niro." So off I went to New York, where Dad, Erica, and the kids were living in an amazing suite at the Waldorf Astoria, having the time of their lives. It was a great trip. We went to Broadway shows, I watched some of the filming, and yes, I got to meet Robert De Niro, which was very exciting, even though he barely spoke or looked at me. While there was some concern that the popularity of The Sopranos would take the wind out of the film's sails, and sales, Analyze This was a big commercial success. Audiences really enjoyed seeing Robert De Niro in his first comedic role, and Billy Crystal was in his neurotic, Jewy element. My dad delighted in his new Cosa Nostra connections, and after giving his local Italian restaurant guy a bit part in the movie, got great tables and free garlic bread for the rest of his life. The studio and all involved parties were very happy with the outcome and aggressively pushed for a sequel. After Ghostbusters 2, my dad had said he wouldn't do another sequel, but he eventually succumbed to pressure from the studio and to the lure of the paycheck they were offering. Analyze That, the sequel to Analyze This, came out in 2002. Due to scheduling issues with Billy and Bob, the entire production was very rushed, and there were days my dad would be writing at the Midtown production office while the rest of the production crew went out scouting locations. One of the assistant directors frequently asked my dad's assistant, Laurel, to go into the office and read over his shoulder to see if the scene said interior restaurant or exterior restaurant, so they'd know what kind of location to look for that day. While my dad was always a collaborative writer, Analyze That took it to another level. I've been told that Bobby the prop guy actually came up with the idea for the heist scene, and because my dad was so far behind on the script, he asked Bobby to just type it up so he could paste it into the scene, after punching it up and adding dialogue, of course. Suffice it to say, the production moved at a frantic pace that my dad was never comfortable with, and I think the movie and his peace of mind suffered for it. Un bon voyage et vérité. In June of 1999, my dad told me to pick any place in the world and he would take me there for a father-daughter post-grad travel adventure. I suggested Portugal or Tokyo, and he said, "Well, yeah, that would be cool. How about northern France?" A road trip through the picturesque French countryside wasn't exactly what I had in mind, but I knew that we would have a great time wherever we went. So we spent a few days in Paris, drinking café au lait and eating pâté and croissant, and then rented a car and took off for Normandy. Dad drove and I tried to navigate as we passed through Vernon, Rouen, Deauville, Etretat, and Saint-Lô. Dad's accent was so good that when we asked people for directions, they would respond in such rapid-fire French that we were left more confused than when we started. Meanwhile, he laughed at my complete lack of French comprehension when I noticed yet another street sign for the Hôtel de Ville and said, "What is that, like a Best Western or something?" We visited Mont-Saint-Michel, stayed in a 16th-century castle for a night, drank Calvados at every opportunity, and laughed and laughed and laughed. We spent an afternoon looking at the Bayeux tapestry, and Dad bought a kit to embroider a throw pillow with the image of Harold, Earl of Wessex, who later became the King of England. We ate the most amazing meal at the Ferme Saint-Simeon in Honfleur, and then went back the next night and ate the exact same thing again. Lobster salad with avocado and citrus dressing, and a steak with morel mushrooms and foie gras, if you must know. We also ate really bad ham steaks in Cayenne at what seemed like a French Denny's. During that trip, while driving to yet another crumbling abbey, my dad said he had something important to tell me. "I know this sounds crazy, but you have a sister." He looked over quickly to gauge my reaction. "Amy Heckerling's kid?" I asked. He nodded, looking confused. "I know. I've known forever." "But what, how?" he sputtered. "Well," I said slowly, "I knew that you and Mom had an understanding. Then, when I was a kid, you took me to the hospital to meet this random woman and her baby. You remember that?" Yeah, it didn't seem like a happy visit, even to a 7-year-old. "What were you thinking? Why did you bring me there? Was I like your human shield?" "Something like that," he laughed. "I think I also overheard you and Erica talking about it once," I lied, not wanting to tell him that I'd read her journal. "And then when I was about 12, Mom and I saw the girl and Amy at a performance art thing, and Mom was like, 'Oh, she looks just like Harold.' So I pretty much figured it out." "You dirty dog." "I'm so sorry, my baby." "It had to be a girl," I teased. "Brothers I'm okay with, but a sister? Come on. I'm supposed to be the only daddy's girl." "I don't think that will be a problem. She doesn't even know." "How is that possible?" "Oh, boy." He took a deep breath. "Well, Amy and I were having an affair, and she got pregnant. She was married at the time, but had had a few miscarriages and really wanted a child, so she said she was going to have it, even though she wasn't sure who the father was. I think she was hoping that I'd leave Anne to be with her, but I knew it wouldn't work out between us. I was just getting involved with Erica. It was a mess. She had the baby, and she never told her husband that there was any question of paternity." "Ouch," I cringed. "Yeah, ouch. Eventually, they got divorced. I suppose he was always suspicious because he did a DNA test and found out that Molly wasn't his biological child. He made Amy swear never to tell Molly, but he called me pretty pissed off and told me. I feel like such a jerk." "You're not a jerk, Daddy." "Well, I'm sure Amy thinks I am. Have you ever seen Look Who's Talking?" "Yeah." "Well, you know that married asshole that gets Kirstie Alley's character pregnant and then won't leave his wife?" "Yeah, that's me." Lasai. Looking back, I wasn't particularly freaked out by our conversation. I was in a great place in my life, so the discomfort I felt when I saw Molly at the art show was long gone. If anything, I felt happy that my dad had trusted me enough to talk to me, and I figured that as long as I was number one, maybe it didn't matter if I wasn't the only one. As the trip came to an end, we spent one last night in Paris before flying out. We had dinner at Brasserie Lip and talked about what the upcoming year might have in store for both of us. As we walked back to the hotel, a light rain fell, and I held on tight to him under the doorman-sized umbrella he always seemed to have handy. "Thank you for a great trip, Daddy," I said, suddenly fighting back tears. "You are so welcome, Dottie. Don't cry. I loved every minute of it, too." In a way, our trip to France felt like a reward for surviving the turmoil of the previous 15 years. We'd made it through the divorce, his remarriage, and my rebellion intact. I had graduated from college with honors, and he was coming off the success of Analyze This, so it was a perfect celebration of our individual successes along with the strength and resiliency of our relationship. The next morning, we flew back to Los Angeles and our separate lives. I prepared for my next move, and he started pre-production for his next project, Bedazzled. To this day, that trip remains one of my most cherished memories of time spent with my dad. Bedazzled, 2000. Written by Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Larry Gelbart, Harold Ramis, and Peter Tolan. directed by Harold Ramis. In this modern take on the classic Faustian bargain, Elliot, Brendan Fraser, makes a deal with the devil, Elizabeth Hurley, to win over his workplace crush, Allison, Frances O'Connor. As he uses his 7 wishes to become the person he thinks Allison wants him to be, Elliot soon discovers that the devil has a wicked sense of humor. Elliot. Why does the existential dilemma have to be so damn bleak? Yes, we're alone in the universe. Yes, life is meaningless, death is inevitable. But is that necessarily so depressing? The new movie has been directed by Harold Ramis from a screenplay that uses the 1967 film more as an inspiration than source. It is lacking in wickedness. It doesn't smack its lips when it's naughty. When its hero sells his soul to the devil, what results isn't diabolical effrontery, but a series of contract negotiations and consumer complaints. Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times. Co-writer and director Harold Ramis analyzed this, working with scripters Larry Gelbart and Peter Tolan, clearly had departure in mind. Fans of the original might cry foul, but the new retooled Bedazzled is loaded with brilliant, witty moments that will have audiences laughing loudly and without the need to indulge in comparative cinema exercises. Peter Stack, sfgate.com. My dad was a huge fan of the 1967 Peter Cook and Dudley Moore film Bedazzled. He loved the Faustian premise of selling your soul to the devil in exchange for the things you think will make you happy, and felt that its theme spoke to a particular paradox of modern life for many people. In an interview for the Bedazzled DVD, he elaborated, "Most people spend their lives in eternal longing, wishing they had something they're not going to get, and even when they get what they want, they find it's really fleeting and not as satisfying as they hoped. We're not happy in ourselves, with our situation. Whatever we have, we're looking beyond to something that could be better." After the shooting at Columbine High School in 1999, my dad felt that this cultural tendency to live in a perpetual wish state really needed to be explored, and decided that Bedazzled could provide a rich creative landscape in which to do so. As the script came together, Dad and the producers began to discuss casting for the film. It was Erica who suggested that the devil be played by a woman. Several well-known female stars were interested in the role, but it was Elizabeth Hurley who embodied the powerful, sexy, playful devil they were looking for. My dad appreciated her confidence and sophistication as a person, and he counted on her willingness as an actor to jump into camp and fantasy as she took on the devil's many incarnations. In casting the male lead, agents and studio executives pushed hard for a big-name comedy actor to play the part of Elliot, but my dad had something else in mind. He wanted someone with tremendously broad range and flexibility as an actor who could really lose himself in the extremes of the wishes depicted in the film. In an interview with Charlie Rose, my dad said, "When we looked at Brendan Fraser's work, he seemed to have it all. In each movie, he was completely different. He's one of those very well-trained classical actors who can really transform himself." My dad and Brendan clicked right away and bonded over a shared drive to create thoughtful, meaningful work. I wasn't around much during the filming of Bedazzled, but I did visit the set for a few days while they were filming on a gigantic soundstage at 20th Century Fox. My dad, once again, was in his element as director. Bedazzled was a big-budget movie with a top-notch crew, great catering, and the most amazing production design I had ever seen up close. When I met Elizabeth Hurley, she was gracious and charming, with the kind of beauty that's almost hard to look at directly. Brendan was warm and down-to-earth and seemed to enjoy working with my dad so much that his eyes would light up in between takes as Dad gave him feedback on the scene. Julian and Daniel were 9 and 5 during the filming of Bedazzled, and it was very circle of life to see them sitting on my dad's lap as he called action, or hanging out with the electricians and prop guys the same way I used to when I was young. At 23, I was more interested in making out with the grips than learning the tools of their trade, but it was sweet the way they let my brothers climb around the trucks and gave them tool belts and little jobs to do. My dad seemed totally delighted with how the production was going and was cautiously optimistic about Bedazzled's anticipated success. Things changed after the first few test screenings when audience expressed their strong dislike for one of the wish segments, a dark Sid and Nancy-esque scene where Elliot and Allison are a rock and roll couple, finally in love with each other, but so miserably drunk, drugged out, and disgusting that after a lot of sloppy kissing, a near overdose, and vomiting on his drummer, Elliot realizes that the bad boy lifestyle is not for him. By the time my dad was forced to admit that the scene had to go, Brendan was already shooting the Mummy sequel in England, so they took the show on the road and filmed an entirely new Wish involving Abraham Lincoln